Today's speaker is Jonathan Porritt. He lives in Britain but has strong ties to New Zealand, where his father, Lord Porritt, was Governor General. Jonathan has been to Australia as well. He's founder director of Forum for the Future, which tries to link corporations with the best scientific ideas concerning the environment. And in the Forum's magazine Green Futures, I was struck by a paragraph in one of Jonathan's columns in which he said, "Most CEOs today just don't read. They're too busy. If it isn't boiled down to two sides and no more, it's just too time-consuming, with the predictable result that a lot of them, however intelligent, are seriously ignorant." Jonathan Porritt on the CEOs of our major firms. And it's a book he's here to talk about today, one that changed the world half a century ago. Jonathan Porritt.
For many people who got involved in the environment movement in the early 1970s, including myself, there were three books that featured pretty regularly in our collective education. Small is Beautiful by Fritz Schumacher, The Blueprint for Survival, published by The Ecologist magazine, and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. They all had a really big impact, in a way that contemporary books about the environment rarely seem to do. 2012 marks the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring. It wasn't Rachel Carson's first book, and some would still argue, from a literary point of view, that it wasn't her best. Her real forte, as a marine biologist, was to conjure visions of the marine environment, in the sea around us, for instance, that have rarely been bettered. But it was Silent Spring that catapulted her from an admired and already hugely successful author into an intensely controversial household name. Silent Spring was a veritable publishing phenomenon. In essence, it's a book about war, the war waged by humankind on the natural world through the use of pesticides of every kind. It's hard for people today to imagine the hubristic arrogance of that era. The big chemical companies were a burgeoning and largely unaccountable power in the land, and most people were in awe at the arsenal of poisons available to control and conquer those bits of nature, insects, pests, weeds, fungi, and so on, that were seen to be holding us back on our route march to the promised land of progress. What were then called broad-spectrum pesticides, including organochlorines like DDT, became the weapons of choice. They were sprayed in staggering volumes to control threats to forest, fields, and human health. The build-up of toxic compounds in birds and other species higher up the food chain became more and more problematic. Now, Rachel Carson was by no means the first to draw attention to the consequences of this barrage of poison, but she was the most eloquent and the most impactful. Her writing style had always been lyrical and expressive, but she was now empowered by William Shawn, the hugely influential editor of The New Yorker at that time, to really let rip. This was a new Rachel Carson, with raw anger pulsing through the prose. You can hear it in countless passages like this. "Who has made the decision that sets in motion these chains of poisonings, this ever-widening wave of death that spreads out like ripples when a pebble is dropped into a still pond? Who has placed in one pan of the scales, the leaves that might have been eaten by the beetles, and in the other, the pitiful heaps of many-hued feathers, the lifeless remains of the birds that fell before the unselective bludgeon of insecticidal poisons? Who has decided, who has the right to decide, for the countless legions of people who were not consulted, that supreme value is a world without insects, even though it be also a sterile world, ungraced by the curving wing of a bird in flight?" Carson hadn't ceased to be a scientist in Silent Spring, but she had certainly crossed over from the business of gathering and sharing evidence to the business of campaigning for change on the basis of that evidence. It was an instant success. She was soon called to testify in front of an influential Senate committee, and over the next few years, in the run-up to the first ever Earth Day in 1970, public opinion swung against this unchecked experiment with the workings of nature. The chemical companies and agribusiness at large did their best to impugn her credentials as a scientist, worse yet, as a female scientist, and she was subjected to vicious personal attacks in the media. But she continued to win the argument. It's important to remind people, 50 years on, that Rachel Carson was not campaigning against the use of all pesticides, although it has to be said that Silent Spring does often give that impression. She just didn't think it was her responsibility to offer up another paean of praise for all the benefits that the proper and responsible use of chemicals was already making available to farmers in those days. Her focus was different. Her focus was on the improper and utterly irresponsible use of chemicals, of which there was then also a huge amount going on. She had a deeper intent as well, to challenge the whole concept of industrial progress and its systematic abuse of the natural world. She dedicated Silent Spring to the great Albert Schweitzer, quoting his words at the start that man has lost the capacity to foresee and to forestall. He will end by destroying the earth. For more than 20 years, Rachel Carson had been warning of the consequences of this kind of alienation from the natural world, writing way back in 1952 the following warning: "Mankind has gone very far into an artificial world of his own creation. He has sought to insulate himself, in his cities of steel and concrete, from the realities of earth and water and the growing seed. Intoxicated with a sense of his own power, he seems to be going further and further into more experiments for the destruction of himself and his world." Rachel Carson's vision of the future was one in which the relationship between humankind and the natural world was far less exploitative, based more on collaboration than outright domination. She advocated a much more cautious, evidence-based approach to economic development, valuing nature more intelligently rather than seeking to convert it immediately into short-term financial gain. Such insights proved to be influential in fashioning what later became known as the precautionary principle. And it was this broader ecological critique that sealed her reputation as the mother of the modern environment movement. But no mother is perfect, and Silent Spring certainly provided plenty of ammunition for Rachel Carson's detractors. It's clear that she was somewhat partial in her own use of evidence, ignoring, for instance, the findings of a number of studies at that time, giving a much less apocalyptic view of the impact of pesticides on bird populations in particular. She also very eloquently asserted a direct linkage between the growing use of death-dealing chemicals, as she often referred to them, and the increase in various kinds of cancer, attributing this phenomenon to the progressive build-up of chemicals in our bodies, to the cumulative poisoning of ourselves. Now, there wasn't a great deal of evidence of that direct cause and effect at that time, and the links between toxic chemicals and the impact on human health remain as controversial today as they were at that time. Carson was also unforgiving in her attack on the use of DDT in particular, and not just in its use in agriculture. Although she was well aware of the horrific impact of insect-borne diseases on human health, including malaria, dengue fever, sleeping sickness, typhus, and so on, she somehow failed to acknowledge that DDT had already played a significant role in helping to control the insects that carry these diseases, and most importantly of all, the mosquito. As a direct result of the campaigning that followed on from the success of Silent Spring, DDT was banned for almost all purposes in the USA by the Environmental Protection Agency in 1972. This in turn put huge pressure on the World Health Organization to withdraw its support for the continuing use of DDT in controlling mosquitoes, carriers of both malaria and dengue fever, despite the fact that DDT was then, and still is, the most effective way of saving lives in many parts of the world. As director of Friends of the Earth through much of the 1980s, I lived through these controversies myself, and though we acknowledged at that time that there was still a role for DDT in malaria control, until such time as better alternatives were brought in, we didn't exactly go out of our way to celebrate the success of DDT in saving so many lives. Our principal concern was to get all organophosphates, not just DDT, banned for use in agriculture, and so we tended to play down the public health arguments. With the benefit of hindsight, I came to the conclusion some time ago that campaigners got this one wrong by not distinguishing between the use of DDT in agriculture and the use of DDT in public health. It's the one part of the legacy of Rachel Carson and Silent Spring that causes me most discomfort. Not surprisingly, the DDT controversy features large in the continuing attacks on Rachel Carson's life and work from those who despise pretty much everything she stood for. The 50th anniversary of Silent Spring has resulted in a number of retrospectives, the most virulent of which is a collection of articles brought together by the Cato Institute, a right-wing, neo-libertarian think tank that has been very influential in the USA over the last 30 years or more. Their overall judgment of Silent Spring is certainly succinct. Vintage, technophobic muckraking in quality literary clothing. I think it's fair to say that this remains a somewhat extreme minority opinion. There are countless people out there, hard at work on environmental issues, for whom Rachel Carson remains a very significant and inspirational figure. It's the passion she brought to bear on the whole pesticide scandal at that time, and the personal courage with which she took that on, that stay in the mind even as the battle has moved on over the last 50 years. Indeed, glancing through the latest publication from the Soil Association, still one of the leading protagonists for organic farming in the world today, seeking to avoid the use of all pesticides, it's clear that this is a battle that has not yet been won. A new class of chemicals that attack the whole system of a plant, often referred to as neonicotinoids, are being used more and more widely, despite growing evidence of their impact on honeybees and other pollinators. And that impact can be felt often at incredibly low concentrations. So the war against nature still goes on. Rachel Carson's stirring work, not just Silent Spring, but in her three books about the marine environment, highlights the folly of this brutal assault. As such, it remains as important today as it was then, and the need to bring forward much more intelligent, environment-friendly alternatives is also as important today as it was then. If people do get a chance to pick up a copy of Silent Spring, it's still an incredibly rewarding read. The sheer intensity of her feelings is still remarkable. One can't help but come to the conclusion that writing Silent Spring was not a pleasurable experience for Rachel Carson at all, but something she felt she absolutely had to do, both to bring to an end the abuse of pesticides at that time and to rally people to a very different way of thinking about our relationships with the natural world.
That was Jonathan Porritt, founder, director of Forum for the Future in London, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring. Next week, Vicky Laurie goes searching for tiny frogs in Margaret River, Western Australia. I'm Robin Williams.